maketh man and person, it might be added, in the 21st century. And although our regular expert Liz Brewer would certainly endorse those issues, it's really vital to ensure that old-fashioned table manners aren't lost forevermore. To address this issue in the light of a recent fascinating survey that's been produced, we're delighted to welcome etiquette expert extraordinaire and ace author and key wonderful all-round soul, Diana Mather. How are you, Diana?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks, Alex.
Always critical. I always thought when you were working with the BBC, it was important that they introduced you fully on that basis.
Oh, it's always wonderful. Nice. That's the best introduction I've ever had.
Well, thank you. Moving on, in terms of table manners, this is a critical thing because, as we said at the top of the piece, really manners are really just good for society to function. If we don't have manners, if we don't have etiquette, if we don't have protocols to go on in certain ways, then we can run the risk of causing offence.
We certainly can. And it's interesting because Rachel's Organics have done this survey. There hasn't been one for a bit. And it's amazing how some things haven't changed, like people don't really like to talk about sex at the dinner table. Other things like elbows on the table don't seem to be very important. But the number one bugbear is phones. You know, people taking selfies, taking pictures of the meal, Instagramming. And that is quite interesting and I think quite heartening, I have to say.
It's fascinating that even Michelle Obama has urged people to stop taking photos of their food at the table.
Absolutely. I mean, technology does have a part to play in entertaining because, you know, these days, you know, you can get your iPad out and follow a recipe, even follow a video while you're actually cooking, which is absolutely amazing and does mean that people are trying things that they probably wouldn't have tried before. I must say, I'm not very good at desserts or puddings, so luckily Rachel's brought out some divine desserts, which I will certainly be using. But that's the end of the phones and the cameras. They should be put away at mealtimes.
So in terms of protocol, would you suggest a basket into which people would actually submit their mobile phone devices, or would you go even further and actually say, no, take out the batteries?
Probably not the batteries, but a basket would be a very good idea, and then leave it in the hall, right out of the dining room or wherever you're eating.
It's an interesting line, and certainly the line of actually introducing sanctions is the next line, I think, from that point of view.
Well, I think some people, you know, they do have this sort of game where the first person to touch or look at their phone has to either do the washing up or pay for the dinner. And certainly anyone whose phone goes off, a lot of people say, right, you're paying for the meal, because they should be off so that we're concentrating on the people that we're with and the delicious food that we're eating.
Without necessarily going down a Pygmalion George Bernard Shaw approach, it's fair to say that knowing the difference between a soup spoon and a dessert spoon could be seen as critical in certain instances.
Well, it can, because more and more employers are taking people out for dinner or lunch to see not only their table manners, but how they actually react with staff as well in restaurants. So not knowing which cutlery to use is why most people come to us at the English Manor, because what they want is the confidence to be able to eat in any circumstances and any sort of food, so that you can enjoy the conversation, you can listen to what people are saying and enjoy the people you're with without having to worry about the cutlery. So, yes, it is important to know the difference between a soup spoon and a dessert spoon.
From the perspective of internationalisation, do you find that culturally we still have challenges with our colleagues over in the States?
Definitely. But the etiquette experts in the States are teaching people to eat continental, as they call it, you know, because they actually think it does look better, which I have to agree with.
Diana, I didn't realise you're an accent expert as well. It's fantastic.
Oh, I'm also an actress, darling, so, you know.
The multi-talented nature continues ever onwards. But certainly from the international perspective, not just obviously in the States, but we have an international culture now. It needs to be appreciative. One needs to be appreciative of obviously different cultures, different manners and different ways of behaving.
That's right. And we have we have an office in China, and we're just opening an academy in Mumbai. And I was taught, because we learn as well, so I know how to eat with chopsticks, and I also know how to eat with chapatis and with my fingers for Indian food. But the Chinese definitely want to learn how to use a knife and fork properly. They want to be able to dine Western style anywhere in the world. So that is a great part of our work, actually, at the moment.
There was a time in the 80s when I seem to remember that talking about mortgages and house prices was getting to be taboo. You mentioned, obviously, talking about sex, most likely to put people off their food, understandably.
And reality TV is another one that's come up in the survey, which is very interesting. Plus, which is actually perennial, is praising one's children too much does absolutely get up other people's noses.
Yes, particularly if you actually pass around photographs of your children and their foods that they've actually been eating recently, which would be just definitely not to work through that. Bringing up the latest diet fad, also not advisable, and will almost set a third of Brits off on a rant, apparently.
Yes, because, I mean, you know, if you've served a lovely chocolate pudding, for instance, and I can't eat that because I'm off any sort of sugar, or it's just not part of my diet these days, is extremely rude. I mean, I have to be careful with gluten, but I just don't eat the bread roll. You know, I don't make a fuss about it, so one should not make a fuss about one's dietary needs.
Rachelsorganic.co.uk is, of course, the website to go to actually find out more about the Divine Desserts range and a whole heap of other scenarios. From your own perspective, Diana, any particular experiences that you've actually had where you've obviously been too polite to mention it at the time, but you thought, well, really, you should have actually waited until I sat down, or at least taken my chair out before? Hand.
I think probably it is for me the way some people find using cutlery, it can look so extraordinarily difficult when actually it isn't. And I really have to zip my mouth not to say anything when people are holding them, you know, in their fists rather than in their fingers. That's probably my bugbear, I think.
And fundamentally, as we say, we need to obviously ensure these civilization aspects come through on that basis, because finger food can be unhealthy as well.
It can indeed. But you see, there's a place for everything. If you're going to, you know, obviously, if you are at a barbecue, you're eating with your fingers. But if there's a knife and fork and you've got a lot of creamy sauces or whatever it might be, then definitely you need to have a knife and fork.
I now appreciate why the Joy of Body Language Secrets and 50 Ways to Be Heard, essential reading in terms of just keeping appraised with respect to how things are actually working on. Both, of course, written by your good self, Diana. We have two final questions which protocol demands we need to put to you at this time. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us and a fairly polite, well-mannered one on the show today?
Totally well-mannered and fascinating. You are wonderful, Alex.
Oh, there we are. I think we should actually look on a head-to-head with yourself and Liz Brewer on the same show. That would be
interesting. Oh, yes, give my regards to Liz, because I do know her. I haven't seen her for a bit, but please give her my best regards.
And I can also vouch for the fact that her daughter Tallulah never actually talks about diets or indeed various other sort of factors at the dinner table. So critical stuff there.
Well, she's obviously brought her up very well.
Diana Mather, etiquette expert and author extraordinaire, we salute you. Many thanks indeed.
Thanks so much.
And we would also know clearly that the world was coming to an end if ever we had a situation where our ace film critic and royal correspondent decided to actually thrust his cutlery into his fists as opposed to his fingers. Isn't that right, Richard Fitzwilliams?
No, I'd be shocked at the thought. Indeed, this I've been listening with great interest, and there's no question about it. Your table manners say so much about you. Mm-hmm. And there is a problem with, I think, quite a lot of people when you see them struggle with the knife and fork when they choose the wrong ones to eat with and so forth. I mean, there's no question table manners still do count, and etiquette is very important. One thing I would say, though, is these days I think we're more used to dietary fads. If you are vegan or vegetarian, I mean, they usually is, in fact, always is now provision for you. So things, I think, have altered in that respect, but it is a delicious anthropological observation to see people when you can see they're a little ill at ease when they shouldn't be.
And I suppose it's the ultimate in definite do not go there if you actually have your mobile phone texting, taking selfies at the dinner table, working through that, and, of course, talking about reality television. It will be a disaster.
Well, I mean, talking about politics and it used to be politics and religion, that's hardly likely now, but certainly controversial subjects I always find enlivens the conversation regarding mobiles and selfies at the table. Well, I suppose if they're all doing it, you're having fun, but if you do it, you speak volumes, you bellow about yourself and the type of person you are and have become.
Precisely. And we have to give a little congratulations to the team that were Linda's a lot, who last night actually beat another 7 other teams who are actually taking part in the now legendary Lincoln-inspired literary quiz, which Ed Wellman and myself hosted with the capable producing team of Sarah Bullimore and Seb, and indeed John Wenham, who did a wonderful round of questions. It was very exciting. It took place at the wonderful Stokes Cafe in the collection, and Linda's Lot, a team of, I believe, four ladies, actually secured 43.5 English points out of a possible 70, which was very good indeed. So there we are. That's marvellous stuff there. It's a very tough quiz as well. Just wanted to give a little heads up to that, Richard, because we did mention it, we do it. And it's one of those reasons why, you know, those of us who have to just keep that stamina going, we keep on, we're ready for the 8 o'clock show. We realise it's an 8 a.m. start as opposed to any other random time that might
actually
occur.
Well, I have to say, with quizzes, better you than me. quizzes reveal, I mean, I have my speciality subjects, quizzes reveal too much about what you don't know in other subjects.
I'll give you a random question here before we move into a selection of movie choices, which are absolutely top hole as ever. One of the questions that we actually had was, and you would get this one easily, which revolution dominates A Tale of Two Cities?
Well, it might be the revolution across the channel, yeah. I think. It is a far, far better thing
exactly.
that I do this day than I've ever done, yes.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. So you would have got one, Richard. There we are.
Well, yes.
If I asked you what was the name of Charles Dickens' wife, would you be on a roll for that?
I would say that there was a very good film which had an excellent cameo performance by a lady playing her, but I would not. No. This is, you see, you're proving my point that the more you go on, the more you'd realise, and listeners would realise, goodness, he doesn't know that.
Well,
that they'd forget what I did know.
Exactly.
And then they'd concentrate. And also the score at the end, there you see you're revealed, rather like the selfie at the dinner table revealing yourself to others. Here you're revealed, as it were.
I know, Richard, you knew it was Catherine who was the name of Charles Dickens' wife, and they were married between 1836 and 1858. I knew you were just waiting.
An enviable liaison, judging by what we know of it today.
Exactly. But you could say Catherine was a dame to die for.
You could indeed. I understand, and I think the film may well have been accurate in this, that Dickens put in the Times a notice of his separation from her when he... she learnt of it first reading it in the paper.
It's equivalent to getting a text message saying, "That's it, love, we're finished."
It's even worse, I have to say.
Yeah, public knowing things.
Before we begin on the week's films, a tribute surely to
Sir Richard.
Perhaps
Lord Attenborough, I should say.
Amazing. I mean, absolutely extraordinary. When you look at the career, you just wonder how he managed to cram in quite as much as he did as a director, as an actor, in the charitable work. I mean, probably the most important figure in British cinema during the period that he was active. And a wonderful bit of luck. I do love these stories because, I mean, we know Sir Alec Guinness had this, I think it was 2.75% of
Star Wars.
Here we have a lovely story where the Attenborough and his wife, Sheila Simmer, marriage nearly 70 years until his sad death, having 10% of the profits of the Mousetrap. And I think the lovely, lovely story that enabled him to make Gandhi, and also what an extraordinary stroke of luck, and somebody who's such a good storyteller, a humanist. I mean, the programme would never end once we began
talking about his career. It'll be touchy-feely stuff in all sorts of ways. And we also have to acknowledge we did work quite extensively with his daughter, one of his daughters, Charlotte Attenborough, in the 80s. We still send our best, obviously, our sympathies to Charlotte. I was fortunate enough to meet Lord Attenborough on one occasion, a wonderful, charming soul, and very passionate, obviously, about the British film industry, and much beloved. And I think, actually, I do feel that although it was panned at the time, and even now I notice that critics were a little bit scathing, I thoroughly enjoyed A Bridge Too Far. I thought actually that was a movie that I know he, on the back of clearly the wonderment that was Oh What a Lovely War, and of course upcoming Gandhi, which in fact will be featuring Shane Rimmer, who portrayed the American commentator in the movie Gandhi. We'll find out what Shane had to think about.
Talking about how the British Raj lost its moral... if it ever had any, the morality of the rule in that scene, as I remember correctly, when the salt protests occur. Very, very memorable. Yes, he was very good.
Exactly. So a nod in that direction as well. So great stuff. Anyway, moving on. The one aspect of filmmaking that, of course, Richard Attenborough didn't really get actively involved with was the what can almost be described as the genre of Frank Millerdom, where we've seen The Shadow, we've seen 300, we've obviously seen the first Sin City, and you've just managed to catch Sin City 2, A Dame to Die For.
Yes, indeed. And well, I do have to say that, look, the critics haven't been impressed by this movie. And, was I impressed? I knew exactly what I was going to see,
lots of thrusting, lots of pelvic thrusts.
Lots of pelvic thrusts, lots of nudity, death.
Exactly. And Jessica Alba. What's not to appreciate about a movie which has got Jessica Alba in there?
I would say that those...
Eva Green as well.
Yeah, Eva Green actually... Naked is one of the most stunning and most memorable aspects of this movie, since she rarely has any clothes on, very occasionally, but not often. But I do have to say, she does have to be a little careful about playing persons of disturbed mind. We saw it in 300 when we had the Battle of Salamis, 300 Birth of an Empire. And,
it's fair to say you might question her sanity as Vesper Lynd in Casino Royale.
Yes, you might. But nonetheless, I have to say with this movie, I rather enjoyed it. The fact that my brain went completely to sleep. You watch a lot of nonsense, but it's well enough shot, stylish, if you like. Certainly scenes I shan't forget, such as someone losing an eye. Well, if you knock someone out properly, you want a souvenir, you reach into their eyes, seize the eyeball and make a ring of it. How about that for the level of fun and games? I mean, the point is that you're looking at a movie where you are going for booze, broads, bullets, murder of every sort type of description. The various plots in the movie, I don't think, matter a great deal. Visually, it is, on the whole, a rather fascinating experience. The cast, as you mentioned, running down all the list of whether it's Mickey Rourke back again, by the way.
Does he ever really go away, Richard?
He did for quite a long time.
That was after he only thought 9.5 weeks should turn into 9.5 years.
Yes, he did, didn't he, Justin? For the wrestler, my goodness me, what a comeback.
Exactly.
But Josh Brolin, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, we forget him for most of the movie, and then he reappears, Rosario Dawson. I mean, you could just go on and on and on. Dennis Hayes, but even Lady Gaga pops up.
Doesn't she always?
Well, I mean, you know what you're going to see with this sort of movie, and to talk about the fact that it doesn't live up to its predecessor and all the rest of it isn't what the fans are interested in. They want cartoon violence and sex, that's what they want. And they certainly get it in spades here. Everything's in spades. I wouldn't dig a hole and bury the movie. It has a certain purpose. The audience who go and see it will enjoy it. And I mean, as for subtlety,
at least it doesn't have Gerard Depardieu getting, into hanky-panky scenario. And indeed, as Alison Wilmore from BuzzFeed Entertainment has actually said, that the movie which floundered at the box office when it debuted this past weekend is just as intensely violent as the original Sin City, lurid and nihilistic as the first one. And this time, of course, it's in 3D, which lends an added oomph to its sometimes beautiful compositions. Disappointing.
Yes, the compositions, absolutely perfect summary. The compositions are excellent, and in fact, you're not looking, as I say, for anything that really contains a story. You're looking for a series of, a nod to Kill Bill here. Even The Hobbit, I noticed they've borrowed the scene where two orcs are killed by the same arrow, this sort of thing. I mean, the point of this movie is obvious. You want an Irish cartoon tale set in a dump where you've got quite an effective visual claustrophobia, and on top of that you've got a lot of well-known names, and you can watch them popping up.
Then you'll enjoy the movie.
And you can quite enjoy the movie, and yes, absolutely.
As you've pointed out, Ava Green, the centre of attention. Ava is less femme fatale than dark deity, a goddess of self-destruction who men can't help but cower in front of.
Yes, and they cower, whether in front of, also her memory seems to obsess them. They do all sorts of extraordinary things. But then throughout this movie, I mean, from the very beginning, you just sit back and basically enjoy the rather strange compositions on screen, quite frankly. If you look for anything more in it, then you can intellectualize for ages. But the main thing is, when there's something to enjoy, which is a bit unusual, why not?
Exactly. So, after we've checked out Sin City 2, A Dame to Die For, where do we go then, Richard?
Well, we go to the Dardenne Brothers, and this is the wonderful little film, 2 Days, One Night. And it has a performance by Marion Cotillard, quite literally to die for. Because, I mean, she is superb. She was excellent in La Vie en Rose. She was excellent in Rust and Bone. And here she's a sufferer from depression. And she takes time off work. Then she gets the sack because the management want to remove an extra worker. They've discovered that 16 can do pretty well the same as 17. And the only compromise is, and this is where the staff have to vote, and this is the moral linchpin of this movie, if they give up their bonuses, she can keep her job. Helped by her husband, she campaigns to keep it. And remember, she's extremely unwell. It's a marvelous piece of acting. I mean, she has a weary beauty. You can see she's not well, and she goes from person to person to try and lobby, and you've discovered a great deal about the lives of some of the individuals who don't want her to lose her job but need the money. So the dilemma is often it might break up a relationship. There might be a violent scene. It is a masterly movie. You can contrast it with the one we've just been talking about, but the one complements the other in a weird sort of way, because movies, you want as big a contrast as you can get. And here you've got a movie that it's touching, it's powerful, it's intimate, and not for a second is it contrived. And Cotillard's performance is as good as she's ever done. The movie did well at Cannes, it got critical raves, and you see somebody who's, I mean, she's attractive indeed. She's struggling still against depression. And she's fighting a war to keep a job, a war for fairness. And of course the overall social message of this movie is that if workers bond together, they've got a better chance of stopping exploitation. But it is a wonderful film. So, I mean, with subtitles, one of those movies that you really find, I would call it a gem.
I would tend to say de jour, une nuit, quite literally.
Yes, indeed, and let's hope that it gets an occasional lift at the box office.
Subtitles
are. Ah, you know, there is a difficulty getting people to.
Do you not think it would be better if we went back to the days of the old spaghetti westerns and when we actually had movies like De Jour, Un Nuit, 2 Days, One Night? You actually had some bad syncing with respect to our voices paying no attention to the characters, but perhaps not. No, forget that suggestion. You see, this is what comes after the quiz. You know, you have that sort of postscript. And not only that,
it's
but
one
of course,
of the problems of the quiz, yes.
Well, exactly. You know, all that and the cartoon museum that we'll be covering tomorrow, astounding. We haven't even started about your wonderful stage show on the epic and the line of that, but that's to come. That's just a little teaser.
A teaser. Amsterdam, I ought to give
exactly.
mention to at least one aspect of it, because it was extreme.
Tulips, perhaps?
Tulips, indeed, and in many paintings. So this is the thing, the impression that you get. I mean, I don't think there's a city in the world that just had so many people use the portrait as a form of recording their lives, which in a country which in the 17th century, I mean, Amsterdam is the richest city on earth, and it's still pretty prosperous, and my goodness me, they keep their museums up absolutely superbly. I spent a long time in the Rijksmuseum. I'd been a couple of times previously. It really is a joy. It's interesting, however, to see it's getting increasingly crowded in the section dedicated to the Golden Age, the age where we had Rembrandt and Vermeer. And
L'âge d'or, to Scott have given another French
yes,
translation.
Indeed, indeed. And so it's not having the same difficulty as the Louvre yet anyway, because they've really taken so much time and trouble over display. And display is fantastic, whether it's a vast portrait of the Battle of Waterloo in the 19th century section, or whether I popped into the 20th century section, that's relatively small. The concentration is on their the great period. But one of the most interesting aspects of this trip, I went back again to see the Museum of Dutch Resistance, and this is so difficult to find, which is all but criminal, because telling the story of the Nazi occupation and subsequently the many, many tragedies that occurred during that terrible period, and also the experiences of the Dutch at the period when their colonies achieved independence, I mean, they tell it through personal stories. It's brilliantly done. And I really recommend this museum if you can find it. It's very, very difficult to find, and that, I think, is somewhat of a crime. I'd also mention that I went to The Hague to see a museum that I was, must confess, I'd heard of it, but knew nothing about it in detail, other than the press here had mentioned that there'd been a very important reopening. It's the Mauritshuis. It's got nearly 900 paintings in it. It is a 17th century building which was once lived in by the Count of Nassau, who was governor of southern Brazil. Not everyone, including myself, knew before my last visit that Brazil had the Portuguese had such interests in so many parts of the world. But here you've got the girl with the pearl earring.
Peter, is that not just Scarlett Johansson from another era, though, surely?
Yes, no, you're quite right, actually. This is Scarlett Johansson, precisely. In another era, and here you can see a painting based on the film. It is actually absolutely wonderful, and indeed the whole museum is fascinating. But there's one bad mistake. Now, here, listeners may have all sorts of views, but when you're restoring a building, it shouldn't be a good idea to take out one of the original friezes and put in a contemporary one. It doesn't work. It is a mess. That apart, it's an experience that, whether you want the Holbeins, the Rembrandts, Jan Steen, I mean, it's an extraordinary. Franz Hals, the Laughing Boy, I mean, the whole thing is a very, very interesting experience in a city that's well worth spending a day going round the various museums, which are rather interesting.
And I'm genuinely delighted that we managed to do a whole feature on museums in Amsterdam without breaking into any kind of cod or artificial Dutch accent, because it's so tempting to do this. We just thought we won't do that in any way, shape or form. We could go into the melancholia of Scandinavian movies, but that would perhaps be a lost cause.
Well, the melancholia of Scandinavian movies, and when you see them on the small screen, it's become a cult. And
it's like dealing with Pieper. Maximilian von Schnell and death.
Maximilian Schnell, actually, his passing. I mean, he gave that brilliant performance as the defense counsel in Justice, Nuremberg, which I hadn't realized, I have to say, when he died some months ago, that he'd had such an extraordinary career, particularly on stage. But I do remember this amazing, electrifying performance on screen.
And Max von Sydow, obviously not appearing in The Keeper of Lost Causes, but this originally was released back in October 2013 in Denmark, and it's directed by Mikkel Nørgaard.
Yes, and Mikkel Nørgaard might pay some attention to the fact that when a politician disappears, and the problem with this movie, it's quite compulsive if you actually are watching it. Then afterwards, when I went with a friend and we came out and started to discuss it, and you realize it's a load of nonsense. Simply because the way, if someone is kidnapped and locked up in a rather curious cubicle with two buckets for obvious reasons, and they remain there whilst the sound is being turned up and up and up, and this goes on for a very lengthy period of time, I do not think they are going to survive unless it's part, dare I say it, of a film where it is part of a plot that has been written by screenwriters.
Well, according to the Sydney Morning Herald, and I know you're always keen to find out what our colleagues on the other side of the ocean and indeed other hemisphere make of these kind of things.
It's the New Zealand Herald that quotes me occasionally.
There we are. Well, the Sydney Morning Herald, according to Sandra Hall, writes, "This Danish thriller brings some new elements to the genre, but at its core is a scenario as old as cinema itself."
Yes, well, that's what we need is a new cliche.
What? sadistic edge to damsel in distress film as the headline.
Maybe, but the point being, sadistic edge to damsel in distress is actually, if well done, exceptionally good. It doesn't matter whether or not it's been done 100 or 1,000 times before. The point is, in an individual film, whether or not it works. The difficulty with this movie, as I say, if you pick over what you've seen, and it is occasionally rather compulsive when you're watching it, my difficulty is that I just do not believe it. She'd die, or at least be in a state that...
On the plus side, Richard, it's actually added another word to the lexicon of film critical review. We've had, of course, rom-com, in terms of romantic comedy. This one has apparently brought to the world womjep. Women in Jeopardy movies. So there we are, womjep.
Well, people who look for...
Almost as old as cinema itself. Perils of Pauline.
Perils of Pauline's about it. If you go to quizzes, you see you learn these extraordinary phrases. I mean, I found the film, I do have to say, The Keeper of Lost Cause is one of those movies that does trade, firstly, in the fact it's Scandinavian, and secondly, it has a weird plot. It's an unusual film, and its bits of it are quite well acted, but... The compelling aspects which you're when you're watching, you suddenly realize this is a load of nonsense. It couldn't happen. It won't really be much of a hit, I don't think.
Well, Keeper of Lost Causes, apparently, as well as you said, Danish and dangerous, means it's an efficiently done and particularly grim tale with a monochromatic palette, bleak weather, and a chronically grumpy hero. It could almost be describing the weather in Lincoln at this moment. So, never mind.
Well, it's very possible, but the point is, the writing is one thing, but what's on the screen is another thing, and I'm just concerned how somebody could survive for very, very long periods of time, and they never get out.
Let's face it. As the Black Widow, Scarlett Johansson wouldn't have actually settled for that. She would have escaped quite easily.
Oh, well, now you're talking about someone who's, well, got even more pull than a politician.
Precisely. I suspect even Eva Green would not have stood for it in any way.
There are some quite telling flashbacks in the movie. That whoever's, as it were, composed this plot has... You know, I mean, it is... Potentially, it was extremely interesting. Mm. But if listeners who see it believe that a human being can survive what the person in this, the protagonist in this movie is supposed to, the chilling, evil man who locks her up, and locks her up in conditions, turning up sound for vast periods of time, she simply would die.
Well, there we have it, you see.
I'm afraid it's as
it's a lost cause. It's a keeper of lost causes.
It's a keeper of lost causes. It's not too bad when you're watching it, but just don't analyse what you've been seeing. Have a few drinks beforehand.
Non-alcoholic ones, we presume.
I think alcohol is important so that you can get through it.
Keeper of lost causes, pretty much a thumbs down there. 2 Days, 1 Night, I think a thumbs up. And indeed, Sin City 2, A Dame to Die For, a kind of, if you like that kind of thing, you like Sin City, you'd probably enjoy that whole thing.
I think Maggie Smith, as the Prime of Miss June Brodie, put it very well. For those who like that sort of thing, she tells a girl who ties knots, Miss Brodie does not think much of knot tying. For those who like that sort of thing, that is the sort of thing they like.
Bringing us right the way back to etiquette as well, and of course museums in Amsterdam that you have to hunt to actually find, and then you get a little hidden gem, quite literally. Richard,
also,
have you
the one rather wonderful, the Royal Palace? If you like these militia paintings, everyone knows the Night Watch, of course, and that's in the Rijksmuseum. But it's quite interesting that they brought back some of the original militia paintings, which are quite a feature of the Dutch artistic landscape and quite unique to Holland, and they've hung them in some newly restored halls.
Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Yes, I certainly have.
And are you back with us in about 24 hours? Not live on Siren 107.3 FM, but in one of our special audio postcards with Professor Jane Chapman and myself at the Cartoon Museum in London.
Look forward to it enormously.